The first few verses of 2 Kings chapter 18 tell us of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Now it came about in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, became king. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. He did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places and broke down the sacred pillars and cut down the Asherah. He also broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the sons of Israel burned incense to it, and it was called Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among those who were before him. For he clung to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Lord had commanded Moses. During Hezekiah's reign over the southern kingdom of Judah, the principal enemy of Judah was Sennacherib, the king of Assyria. By this time, the Assyrians had already conquered the northern kingdom of Judah and God's people in that portion of the promised land had been taken away into captivity and would never again reassemble as a separate nation of people. All throughout the reign of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib tried to take the southern kingdom as well. But God was always with Judah in turning the Assyrians back. And finally, in the end of 2 Kings chapter 19, the Bible tells how that the king of Assyria was assassinated. His son came to the throne, and the Assyrians then were no longer a threat to God's people. Then 2 Kings chapter 20 opens with these words. In those days, Hezekiah became mortally ill. The Bible goes on there in that place to tell how that God's prophet, Isaiah, came to Hezekiah and he pronounced these very ominous words to him. Set your house in order, for you are going to die. Perhaps you've read this story. I'm sure you have. Maybe you remember some of the details, how that King Hezekiah was overcome with grief, and the Bible says that he turned his face to the wall and he began to pray and to cry, and ultimately God said, I've heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. God said, I'm going to extend your life 15 more years. And so Hezekiah was permitted to live an additional 15 years. And he continued to reign over the southern kingdom of Judah for that time. It was shortly after that time that Hezekiah had some visitors. These visitors came from the far away kingdom of Babylon. And when Hezekiah received them, they congratulated him upon his recovery and his good health. And he gave them the grand tour, beginning with Isaiah chapter 39, verse 2. Oh, you may have missed the fact that I've jumped from 2 Kings chapter 20 over to Isaiah chapter 39, because interestingly enough, this very account is included in Isaiah's writings in the prophecy of Isaiah. A little small section is dedicated to the history surrounding this time during the reign of King Hezekiah. And so we go to Isaiah chapter 39 to get a full account with the details of this story. And we begin reading at verse 2, taking up the story at the point at which the Babylonians have come and have brought letters congratulating him on his recovery. Hezekiah was pleased and showed them all his treasure house, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious oil and his whole armory and all that was found in his treasuries. There was nothing in his house nor in all his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah the prophet came to King Hezekiah and he said, "What did these men say? And from where have they come?" Hezekiah answered and said, "They have come to me from a far country, from Babylon." You know, if I could pause in the account at this point for just a minute or so, I think in my mind's eye, I can truly picture King Hezekiah recently recovered from that deadly illness, whatever it was, by the grace of God, of course, and very pleased that someone from as far away and from such a great place as Babylon has sent an ambassage there to congratulate him and to see the things. And you know, he's just puffed up like an old peacock as he leads them all around Jerusalem and shows them the treasure house of the palace and all of the gold and precious things in the temple and all of the finery having to do with his dominion and his reign. And Isaiah, old Isaiah, comes along and says, "Hezekiah, who is that?" And Hezekiah says, "They've come from a far country to see me. They've come from Babylon." And then Isaiah said, "What have they seen in your house?" So Hezekiah answered, "They have seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among my treasuries that I have not shown them." The title for our lesson this morning comes from Isaiah's question. What have they seen in your house? You probably know the rest of the story, how that Isaiah went on to tell Hezekiah that Babylon would ultimately become the enemy of God's people. And in fact, they would eventually, the Bible uses the term in several places, pluck the people up out of their land. Eventually, Babylon would come and carry off all the people. And I can just see Isaiah spreading his arms and saying, "And all of these treasures, they're going to carry them away. And your descendants, those of your own bloodline, will be carried into that far country and made servants in the palace of that heathen king." We know that what Isaiah prophesied there literally did come to pass a little over 100 years later, and the Babylonians captured Judah and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple and carried the people away for 70 years of captivity. Now that's about as far as we're going to go with that brief glimpse of history. What we want to do now is turn our attention to that question that Isaiah asked Hezekiah. What have they seen in your house? And as we get into this lesson, I want to acknowledge a couple of things. Number one, Isaiah has reference here to the treasures and the physical objects in the storehouse of the king of Judah. Hezekiah seems to be very proud to show off all of his treasures. I don't know about you, but I've got a little handful of treasures that I'm very glad to have. And I have to work hard on not making those things more important than they really need to be. Whether it's the things that I've acquired, things that I've made, things that someone precious to me made and used in years gone by. Any number of things, and I think I see some understanding on your faces as I mention these things, because we've all got some things that we're glad that we have. And Isaiah was talking about those kind of things that Hezekiah had accumulated, his treasures, and we need to be careful that we don't put too much emphasis on those physical things. But our emphasis, as we apply that question to us this morning, is not going to be on the physical decorations. But rather, I want us to think about the spiritual principles and positions and characteristics of our own home. Now that brings up the second thing that I need to say. While the house that Isaiah and Hezekiah were both talking about was the physical palace in Jerusalem, we're talking about the home. Not the physical structure that stands there at that address where you say that you live, but the home as in the abstract realm of the family. We often illustrate the term and the concept home with the place or the object, the structure in which we live, but we know that that's not really the home. That's the house. The home is what we sung about in those three songs that just preceded this portion of our worship. The home, the institution in which God is either welcomed or rejected. And so with those things in mind, let's turn that question upon ourselves now and ask us, what have they seen in your house? I'd like to share three simple points with you, three simple questions. In your house, have they seen spirituality emphasized? I'm sad to say that the average American home today has very little room and very little time for spirituality. We have come to regard spirituality as having its place here in the church building. That's where people in general today, by and large, consider the place for spirituality. May I suggest, in fact, may I insist, that if there is no spirituality in our homes, then whatever spirituality exists here, especially for our own sake, is somewhat lacking. The average American family today doesn't even have time to sit down together and enjoy an evening meal, for example. Some of the fondest memories that I have, in fact, some of the most solid memories that I have, go back to the supper table in my mother's kitchen. It was a place where every evening at a certain time, and that time was always made known. Sometimes it was announced on the spur of the moment, like, supper's ready. But that was all it took. And whatever was going on at the time, whatever television program might, contrary to what some of you probably believe, I did live in the days of television in my childhood. If whatever television program was on, we didn't have a television set in the kitchen. Television was turned off. Whatever activity was going on at the time was stopped, and we would all come to the table. I didn't have to take my cap off when I got to the table because, you see, it had been left at the front door. If I'd come inside the house with it on, I would have been subjected to some rather, well, let's just say, harsh reminders. And we sat down at the table, and not a morsel of food was touched until we had given thanks. Obviously, that's a practice that many families don't observe anymore because we seem to be in such a big hurry that that's one of the things that we, I guess, feel has we've been able to sort of weed that one out. That's an inefficiency that we don't have to honor, and so we're going to hurry up and we're going to eat. We always gave thanks at the table. There wasn't any gobbling it down and jumping up and running off. No, we didn't have to say, may I be excused or anything like that. And if you did, though, I think that's probably paid off for you in later life. But there was a sense in which every member of the family respected the time and the effort that had been put into preparing that meal for us to enjoy. Now, don't you go say that your preacher said, if you don't sit down and eat supper together, you're all going to hell. That's not my point at all. But it's just one of the many illustrations that we could all call to mind from earlier days and what we sometimes refer to as more pleasant times when certain things were given a little bit better emphasis. But what about spirituality in our home? Do we value the right things and reject the right things? Or do we allow the wrong things in and let them take so much of our time that we no longer have the time to emphasize the right things? Are our homes miniature illustrations of the national problem that we have today? That Isaiah makes reference to in Isaiah chapter 5 when he said, woe unto them that call evil good and those that call good evil. There is no better place for children to receive the kind of teaching and influence that causes them to appreciate spirituality than in the home. Along this same line, number two, we could ask the question, have they seen any good influence in your home? Like the ripples around a splash on the surface of the water, influence, whether it's good influence or bad influence, it radiates out of every single home. This influence should come in the way of godly example, especially from the adults. It should be seen in the form of the instruction and the teaching that's given in the home. The passage that Douglas read to us a few minutes ago from Genesis chapter 18, verse 19, was a reference to Abraham and the fact that God said, "I have known him," in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord, to do righteousness and justice. God was obviously well pleased with Abraham's influence in his home. The Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 1 verse 5 says, "I'm filled with joy when I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I'm persuaded is in you also." The things that we teach our children, the things that they see us exemplify, will be longer remembered than anything else. The example that we live cannot be overemphasized. I heard of a bald-headed merchant back in the older days, standing in the shop door when a man stopped by and asked him if he had any hair restorer. "Yes, sir, step right inside. Here's a product that I can heartily recommend. Testimonials are many from those who've used it. Why, this makes hair grow in just 24 hours. The man said, "Okay, I'll tell you what. Why don't you rub a little tad right there on the top of your head, and I'll be back this same time tomorrow and see how it works, and then maybe I'll buy some." Well, you know, that's the kind of proof that we'd like to have when we purchase a product or hear a claim. What's the proof in our home? There's a third thing that I want to share with you. In our homes, have they seen biblical roles for each family member? In Colossians chapter 3, beginning in verse 18, and incidentally, you'll find almost the same words in Ephesians chapter 5. But here in Colossians chapter 3, Paul says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting to the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." Let's consider those roles just briefly as we conclude our thoughts. The father and husband should be the cornerstone of discipline, strength, and the upholder of responsibility as the head of the house. I understand full well that there are many families today that do not have fathers present, that do not have husbands there to carry on that duty. And we mourn and weep with those who are discouraged by that situation. And you might say that this message here is especially for the young people. The message to be very careful in choosing a mate. And the message is also to the older people, for the sake of being careful to teach those young ones yet to form families as to how it needs to be done according to God's will. A Christian husband and father must be a gentleman always. Violence, sensuality, greed, those kind of things need to be far, far away from his behavior. lest he lose the souls of those who are entrusted to his care. Let me put this in as plain a language as I know how to use tastefully. We are astounded as we read statistics today regarding young people and how faithful they stay to the church, even when they're raised up in the church. You might say that the failure rate is just beyond comprehension. It's high enough to make us throw up our hands and say, how in the world are we letting this happen? And yet it seems that so far we've been unable to change the trend. Let me say this clearly. When young folks who are brought up in the Lord's church and who become members of the church and are taught in the right way, come under the influence that is never countered in the home, come under the leadership of those who will lead them away, and the home allows them to do so. We do understand, don't we, that those children, if they never come back to the Lord, are going to be lost. They have no eternal future so far as blessings are concerned. The only future they have, if they never return to the Lord, is a future of being lost. I just want to make sure we all understand that, because there are many today who seem to be ignoring that idea. That if kids go away, that if they fall away from the church, if they grow up to become unfaithful to the Lord, and we allow them to go that way without ever trying to bring them back, if we are not successful in bringing them back, they're going to be lost. And so I say that a father has a great responsibility in fulfilling the role of a teacher for his children. And I think we'd all agree that the reluctance of fathers to fill their roles today is becoming the shame of our culture. The value of the home is greatly increased, or, as the case may be, diminished by the wife and the mother in that home. A Christian wife and mother sets a moral tone of the home and will often be called upon to exhibit some of the greatest sacrifice that a person ever has to make. Her job is never done, neither by day or by night. It is constant and abiding, and she must constantly be involved with the managing of the house and its resources. Her light should light up the home like a beacon in the night. Her joy is in her family, and she should protect the love of the Lord on the part of her children with her deepest effort. The role of Christian sons and daughters is clear in God's Word. It has certainly fallen under disregard today and is even subject to contempt by those who want to foster the idea that rebellion and recklessness are wholesome parts of the task of growing up. Children must be obedient to their parents, Ephesians 6, verse 1. Romans chapter 1, verse 30 lists the sin of disobedient to parents right alongside some of the most egregious sins that have ever been called to mind. Children must be respectful to their parents, to God and His will, to whatever authority exists in a normal society, as long as it does not conflict with God's way. Children need to be modest. In a time when modesty is not considered popular, even among, or maybe we should say especially, among young people, Christian children need to be known for their integrity, their morality, their honesty. Deceit and deception must be far away from them and their daily lives. The easiest way to become godly spouses and righteous parents is to be taught how to live a life of godly, righteous children. There are no shortcuts. What have they seen in your house? You know, in all likelihood, there's a whole lot more that needs to be seen. Obviously, there are a lot of things that should never be seen in your house and in my house. Consider carefully the instruction of God's will for our family. You need to respond to the Master's invitation, either in obedience to the gospel through faith, repentance, confession, and baptism, or to be restored to faithfulness. We extend the invitation to you, invite you to respond as we stand and sing.